Jason Palmer, one of the hosts of The Intelligence, The Economist's daily current affairs podcast. The Economist's award-winning shows make sense of what matters, from our special series on China's president to our weekly podcasts on business, technology, and American politics. Our journalists provide fair, in-depth reporting on the events shaping the world. To get the annual plan for less than $2.50 per month, search for Economist Podcasts Plus to start listening today.
Jared Cohen joins us now, founder and CEO of Jigsaw at Alphabet, former advisor to two secretaries of state, Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton, and best-selling author of five books, his latest being Life After Bauer, Seven Presidents and Their Search for Purpose Beyond the White House. And Jared, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Brian.
So first off, the attraction of wanting this job back, this is what Lindsey Graham told me. I met with Trump after he lost, and I told him, you don't need to do this. You don't need to run again. Go golf. Go do a tour of the world. You know, you don't need to do it. You know, your celebrity's going to pick up. But yet he wants to get back. That's all he does to get back. From your experience studying what this position's about and how hard it is to turn the page after you leave the White House, do you understand it?
Look, presidents don't want to think about their time in office as their penultimate act, right? They view it as their greatest act, which is why they don't want to give it up. It's the most dramatic retirement in the world, which is why the founding fathers worried about what to do with ex-presidents. You know, Alexander Hamilton pondered this question of, you know, is it good for the republic to have half a dozen men at any given time wandering around the rest of us like disenchanted ghosts or discontented
ghosts? And he wrote, and you wrote that quote before in your book.
He writes it in Federalist 72.
What worries him?
Well, so I think what worried him is, remember, they were trying to construct a republic in response to a monarchy, right? There weren't a lot of examples that the founding fathers had for the peaceful transfer of power. What they were creating was something truly novel. They just had a lot of things on their plate. And I think what's amazing about this question of what to do with ex-presidents, we never really formalized it in the Constitution. We kind of winged it throughout history, and there's not a lot of good examples. What I do in the book is I basically highlight seven U.S. presidents who managed to find a greater sense of purpose after they left the office.
So one thing that struck people is that President Obama chose to stay in Washington. I know he's young, but a lot of people say, you know, I'm going to move on. You know, Kenny Bunkport, where 41 stayed, and Reagan went to his ranch, and LBJ went to his ranch in Texas. How unique is it that he stayed in Washington and seems to still be a player?
So John Quincy Adams was the first one to stay in Washington, but the circumstances were very different. His wife was terribly ill, and it was too icy, and he couldn't make the journey back up to Quincy. But I think what you see with President Obama is something that a lot of former presidents, particularly in modern times, struggle with, which is they're constrained by the norm of one president at a time, but they just can't resist the urge to keep their toe in the water. They can't resist the urge to insert themselves. And the symbolism of a former president staying in Washington, to me, symbolizes and captures this idea of how difficult it is to let go.
Right. Maybe not great for the country, especially with people's perception. People's perception is that your older vice president is president. He is not at the top of his game. Who's calling the shots? Could it be that guy 5 miles away?
And by the way, it's very confusing. If you look at Jimmy Carter, right, you know, longest active post-presidency in history, 42 plus years, he's the answer to Hamilton's question of what to do with ex-presidents, which is they can either be a tremendous ally to their successors or they can be a nuisance and their most formidable adversary. And Carter managed to do both. But he didn't do it living in Washington. He went back home to Plains. And
You're referring, Jared, to the fact that he went over to North Korea. He got involved there trying to get hostages out. He went over to Haiti. He was over there trying to run elections internationally. And a lot of times I think he got on Bill Clinton's nerves a little bit too.
I mean, Carter is a tremendous contrast. And again, he represents the best and the worst of what ex-presidents can do. So he goes over to North Korea as a messenger for the Clinton administration and Clinton in 1994. And Clinton tells him, under no uncertain terms are you to make any policy? And Carter says, fine. And then Clinton turns on CNN and there's Carter announcing a nuclear breakthrough. By the way, when the U.S. when George H.W. Bush was readying to send troops in to get Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, Jimmy Carter, who didn't want to see a war, secretly wrote to four of the five permanent members of the Security Council urging them to oppose his own country's policy.
Unbelievable. Who are the seven and why'd you pick them?
So I chose Thomas Jefferson, John Quincy Adams, Grover Cleveland, William Howard Taft, Hoover, Carter, and George W. Bush. Each one of those seven men had something that they were deeply principled about. They doubled down on those principles after they left the White House and ended up finding greater purpose than their time as president. Thomas Jefferson went on to found the University of Virginia. It's one of only three things he includes on his tombstone. He doesn't include being president. John Quincy Adams had arguably the greatest second act in American history. He served nine terms in the House of Representatives. We're in a much lower station. He found a much higher cause of abolition. Cleveland became president again, so kind of hard to argue with that. William Howard Taft got his dream job as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in his final decade of life. Herbert Hoover's story, you know, this is a
after member William Howard Taft famously went against Teddy Roosevelt, challenged the guy he mentored, and Woodrow Wilson ends up becoming president. But what happened to him after?
Yeah, so William Howard Taft, he didn't like being president. He was actually all he ever wanted was to serve on the Supreme Court. He turns it down three times in his life before becoming president. He nominates a record six justices to the Supreme Court, including a chief justice as president. The only reason he seeks re-election in 1912 is to deny his one-time friend and former mentor Theodore Roosevelt the presidency. It's an amazing story because by the time Taft, you know, gets the nomination for the Republican Party, he's basically a political dead man, and his vice presidential running mate dies just a week before the election. So you literally have, you know, Theodore Roosevelt as a third-party bull moose challenging the incumbent president whose ticket is literally a political dead man and a physical corpse. And he splits the party and gives the election to Wilson.
Teddy Roosevelt actually got the second most votes as a third party, right?
And you end up with Woodrow Wilson, you know, for 8 years as president.
Right.
And then look, you know, Herbert Hoover, this is a man who lived to be 90 years old. He's defined by, you know, 4 years that he was in office, defined by the Great Depression. His story is a great one of recovery. He recaptures, you know, his, you know, status as a great humanitarian, which he had before being president. He recaptures his status as a great executive, you know, reorganizing the executive branch. And he recaptures his status in his lifetime as a bipartisan figure when Joe Kennedy calls on him to reconcile JFK and Richard Nixon after the 1960 election.
Wow, pretty amazing, because obviously that was a controversial result.
And it was important because the country was sort of in the height of the Cold War, showing that bipartisan unity was important. And, you know, I think the tragedy for Herbert Hoover, who's still getting kind of trashed and whose name is still political fodder, you know, even in this election, he actually recovers his good name in his lifetime and then just gets trashed again posthumously.
Right. And you're talking about the fact that Donald Trump said, if the economy is going to collapse, I hope it collapses under him because I don't want to inherit something like Herbert Hoover.
I mean, the FDR guys, they really did a job on Herbert Hoover. You know, his 12 years of self-imposed political exile, I mean, it just felt like the FDR presidency would never end. And it's interesting. Harry Truman resurrects Herbert Hoover in 1945 after FDR dies because he's staring, you know, the end of the war, World War II, on the horizon. And there's only one man in history who knows what it's like to be president of the United States and feed a world that's facing starvation. So he and Herbert Hoover, they form this kind of unlikely partnership. But then every time there's an election, Truman goes out and talks about Hoovervilles and talks about Hoover carts. And it's just this torturous experience for Hoover that his entire life, every single election, no matter what he does, he still becomes a soundbite on the election trail.
I think his great granddaughter is Margaret Hoover. And I got to know her a little bit. And she really is making that a mission to enough, you know, and this when this came up again, he says, we should correct the record on that.
Yeah. First of all,
a lot of stuff you inherit. Let's be honest.
Look, Margaret talks about how, her father, who was Herbert Hoover's, you know, grandson, gets a punched in the face on the schoolyard for being tied to, you know, a man that you know, it was his grandfather. And look, you know, Margaret's one of the great Americans. She and I have talked a lot about Herbert Hoover over the years, and we're on kind of a mission to make Herbert Hoover great again.
Oh, that's awesome. All right. I'll join in that. I love people to make a difference and they don't get credit for it. So if you can rehab it, that's fantastic. So one of my favorite all-time people is George W. Bush. And I just thought the perfect name of his book was Decision Points, because that's him. Like, oh, okay, you're critical of my decision. All right, it's fine. Let me just put you in my shoes. And then if you're still critical, that's fine too. But maybe you should learn a little bit about what my decision, what was at stake when I made the decisions I made. He wanted to be the education president. Then 9/11 happened. And people say, well, you know what? There was a report over the summer that said bin Laden was determined to attack in America. How did you miss that?
So George Bush chapter in the book, I call it Moving On. Because when I looked at the active living presidents, there was only one whose popularity had doubled. And I figure, you know, even for—
It's his.
Yeah, and it's his. And by the way, he's accomplished that by investing less in his, you know, legacy than any of his active contemporaries. It must drive Bill Clinton completely mad.
By the way, I love his library. I had a chance to see it.
And look, his library is a reflection of his values. But I think part of why I wanted to understand why Bush's popularity had more than doubled. I think, look, he has this reverence for the Washington principle of when it's over, it's over. And you have to separate from politics after you've been president. It's aged well, given you have a former president, Donald Trump, who's now, on the path to the nomination. And let's just say he's not quiet. But I also think that, Americans have gotten nostalgic about this idea of a president who kind of reveres the Washington principle of one president at a time. And they like watching him paint, right? I mean, Bush is in his mid-70s and they're seeing him, kind of find a post-presidential voice through painting that allows him to advance causes that matter to the American people, like veterans, without undermining his successors.
Jared Cohen with us. He's got his book out now, Life After Power, Seven Presidents and Their Search for Purpose Beyond the White House. What I also think is fascinating, and I saw it up close, is Bush 43 is tied with Bill Clinton, who beat his father. And his father and Bill Clinton got along. And it was great to see Bill Clinton look up to 41. And they did a lot of things together. I think the American people love seeing that. And then when Barack Obama came president, he was saying so many negative things about Bush 43. And Gates writes about it in his book. Say, hey, guys, I'm here. Because the Secretary of Defense carried over to the Obama administration. A lot of stuff that you're saying is flat out wrong, and a lot of decisions we made are a lot better than you think, and we'll kind of stick up for it. And 43 kept quiet, always kept quiet. And then when it was time to dedicate the library, President Obama shows up, and he says something, if I can remember correctly, he says, you might disagree with George Bush, but it's impossible not to like George Bush.
I think that's right. Look, out of the 45 men who served as president 46 times, because Cleveland did it twice, only one president has been so dogmatically disciplined about fading from politics. Bush never mentions his successors by name. He never hits the campaign trail publicly. He doesn't insert himself.
He did once with Jeb, right?
But it was an act. But it was actually recorded. It was a private event.
Okay.
And he described it as one of the most cringeworthy moments of his post presidency. And it's a moment that he reminded himself that you have to be disciplined, not just in public, but also disciplined in private. And George W. Bush, look, the symbolism of two former foes coming together is also a reminder that this very idea of a former president, it's a feature of a democracy. It's not a bug. And particularly at this moment, people may not like the current set of circumstances, but there's a lot of countries where you don't get to be a former president. Or if you are, you're either, in prison for life or suffering some kind of other ill fate.
Right. You know who also had those qualities that never became president is John McCain. And I know that when he was able to give credit to Barack Obama after he lost that crushing defeat to him, and he just able to outline that moment, I think it's just so important to learn how to lose. Bush 41 knew how to lose. He hated losing. We got those tapes later on where he talked about how he thought he let everybody down by losing to Bill Clinton. But he lost with grace.
Yeah, I think that's right. By the way, it's a worthy time to reflect on Grover Cleveland as well, because this election is likely going to feature the only—
Can I talk about Grover Cleveland when we come back?
Yes.
All right. So Jared Cohen, it's great to have him here. He's an advisor to Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton, best-selling author, a perspective about the times we're going through, because some of which is unprecedented to a degree, but not as much as you think. Don't move.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back. The author of Life After Power, Jared Cohen, with us right now. He's got a great book out, it's called Seven Presidents and Their Search for Purpose Beyond the White House. Grover Cleveland, we keep hearing about this. First time we're seeing a president very close to getting back into office, and it's President Trump. He wins, he loses, and he wants to win again. How rare is this?
So first of all, historically, you know, in my, you know, the Grover Cleveland chapter is called, you know, the comeback. And, you know, it's not, you know, historically, former presidents have not made good presidential candidates. You know, this is going to, this 2024 election is likely going to be the first and only time since 1892 where two former presidents have had a rematch as nominees.
And who was that in 1892?
So it's Grover Cleveland versus Benjamin Harrison.
Okay.
And Cleveland, when he's elected in 1884, is the first Democrat elected president since James Buchanan before the Civil War. And what people don't realize about Cleveland is he never loses the popular vote. So that's already different from the 2024 election. He actually threw away the presidency in 1888 on a principle of standing strong on a low tariff. And he said he's never been happier than when he threw away the presidency. And he also, you know, entered office as a bachelor at 49 years old, married a 21-year-old who's the youngest first lady in American history. And he doesn't fantasize about going back into office. The only reason he tries to make a comeback is similarly on principle. He's worried the Harrison administration is driving the economy into the ground. He's worried about a rising tide of imperialism, and he's worried about runaway populists within his own party and within the Republican Party. And so he makes a sort of reluctant comeback, but he wins the popular vote three times in a row.
Wow. And so, and then becomes president again. And somewhere in the between there, Teddy Roosevelt is cutting his teeth and getting ready. And the turn of the century would be the rise and in the beginning of the end of imperialism, right?
That's right. And look, you know, Grover, what I say in the book is Grover Cleveland's comeback is a cautionary tale. Right. You know, first of all, comebacks are easy to ponder. They're hard to accomplish. And when you accomplish, it's rarely the same and as sweet the second time around. The context changes. You come in overconfident. You think you know how to do it. The dynamics are different. The day Grover Cleveland takes the oath of office for his second non-consecutive term as president, he inherits the worst economic depression in the country's history. American settlers in Hawaii have set in motion a process that would lead to the annexation of the islands. And he feels a lump on the top of his mouth and realizes that he may have terminal cancer.
Wow. Couple of things. One thing Trump says on and off camera, I know exactly what to do now. And one thing Bill Clinton expressed is frustration, because I get it. I know exactly how to do this job. Same with Barack Obama. He's like, I get it. It takes a while, especially it's harder now, I think, today. It takes a while, but they seem to get it. So Trump can't wait to put people in power again.
Yeah, look, I think the second –
There's no ramp-up time.
There's no ramp-up time, but – a lot has changed in the 4 years. The interregnum, you know, is an interregnum that a former president doesn't have a front row seat for. You know, they're not in it day to day, right? You know, they're both nostalgic for the last time around, and their frame of reference reflects a set of biases and assumptions from the last time around, and they bring that to the second presidency. And so, you know, Grover Cleveland's, you know, second presidency was not a pleasant one. He you know, again, this is a man who won the popular vote three times. He left office the second time, deeply unpopular, deeply depressed, and just having lost valuable years he could have spent with his young bride.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.